Welcome to Jewish History with Rabbi David Katz, connecting the human side to Jewish history. For sponsorship opportunities or to support this podcast, please visit our donate page at www.support.rabbidavidkatz.com.
Hi, it's Wednesday afternoon, and I want to do another one, maybe the last one from the Gnozim catalog. The Gnozim auction, again, is this coming Sunday, and I think Tuesday, March 3 and March 5, if I remember correctly. The catalog is out. You can see it online. I got a physical copy sent to me. Naturally, I don't know where I put it. And but one was called to my attention, was suggested to me, was to do lot number 106, I think. And that is, yeah. Now, the original printing of the Chassid Yavetz on Pirkei Avos, one of the old golden oldies, one of the classics. So I was thinking I should do it. I shouldn't do it. I don't have the Chassid Yavetz on Avos, but I see it sometimes in the, you know, what's it called? Shmuel Dozida, the, that Medrash Shmuel, on, which is like a Shidim with a Betzis on Pirkei Avos. From one of the Talmidei Arizal, very famous. And naturally, my Medrash Shmuel is Menuchot. And for some reason, there was like a major explosion of commentaries on Pirkei Avos in the 1500s. It's interesting, especially by the Sephardim and the Eastern type of Jews. And our hero, Chassid Yavetz, is one of the main ones. Not the only one, one of the main ones. And he died in 1508, I think. So this is published by his children or grandchildren or something in Turkey in 1555. So what they're offering is the original edition, the first printing of the Pirush of Yavetz, who I'll explain about in a second. I'll try to. In the 16th century, Yavetz lived in Spain and Italy, and this was obviously published. I mean, by the 1550s, I don't even know if it was safe to publish a Hebrew book in Italy, or shortly afterwards it wasn't. But in Turkey, it was okay. I mean, the Turks didn't care. So, if you're interested, this is the first printing of this business. I think it's, if I remember correctly, it's going for like 30K, something like that. Here it is, between 20 and 40K, if you're a player. I'm not a player, I'm an observer. Now, I was thinking, should I do it? I shouldn't do it. And, well, Akim Ino Liyoto. And then a Maisa happened to me today, as I speak. And I took it as a sign from upstairs that I should do this podcast. The Hainu. I went to the bookstore, not the regular one I go to, this farm store, a different one, looking for a certain item. And meanwhile, I came across something I didn't see before. Believe it or not, there's a brand new edition coming out in pieces of exactly the Chassid Yavetz on Pirkei Avos. And I couldn't believe it. And it's like brand new. It's a deluxe business, not only with the kudos, but with extensive mafarshim and shinei neschos and the ganze business. You know, it's for those who are really into this. And I said, this cannot be a coincidence. And so I bought and brought it home. And I'm looking at it. And I'm seeing his constant references to Dvus Rishon. And I say, this means I should talk about it. So this is something Gnozim is offering. Lot number 106, Gnazym is Gnozim. And you go online, you can see it. And here, it depends if you're a 16th century person or if you're a Pirkei Avos person or whatever. It's called the Pirush of the Chassid Yavetz. Let's get one thing straight. There's a guy in the Tanakh called Yavetz. After that, in Jewish history, there were certain families called Yavetz. Yaakov Emden, who I'm not talking about, lived in the 18th century, and he's called Yavetz, right? Because it's a play on words. Yavetz. Yaakov Ben Tzvi. His father was Chacham Tzvi. So that's Yavetz with a V. The other guys, like the one we're talking about, are Yavetz, which is a Jewish name. It's from the Bible. It's from Divrei Yomam. And it was a Chassid of a Sephardi family, as we shall see. among other things. And our hero is from that family. Now, we're dealing with somebody who, and I don't see it usually, I mean, in the biographies, in my humble opinion, which is all I ever have, I don't think it's portrayed properly. So I'll give you my take. We're dealing with a guy who lived from 1440, approximately, we don't know exactly, till 1508, maybe 1438, you know. So basically, we're talking about somebody who lived, what, between 60 and 70 years. Okay. He's from Spain, but he's a from guy. That's an understatement. And therefore, he left Spain in 1492. And he ended up, from 1492 to the end of his life, it's another 16 years, 15, 16 years, in Italy and various places, as we shall see. So we're basically dealing with someone who, when the expulsion came from Spain, he was already a guy in his 50s. His name is Yosef Yabetz. He's from, so they call him a Chassid Yabetz. But it's Yosef Yabetz, okay? Or to be exact, Yosef Yabetz. Now, this is, to me, extremely interesting from several perspectives. I have, a couple months ago, I think, did a whole bunch of talks from the 15th century in Spain. Shemta Ben Shemta, Yosef Ben Shemta, those guys. I did the Akeda, Compton, I think. So, let me put it this way. Spain, as you know, is one of the places where Limud HaTorah took off. That is not true of all Jewish communities. There are plenty of Jewish communities that may or may not be interesting from one perspective or another, but they didn't come places that produce culture, especially Torah culture. There are a few of those. And what happens is they flourish in one place, but not in another place. But then, as is almost the invariable rule of Gullus, when it comes to an end, for one reason or another, the refugees run away and go to another place, and the question is, how will they fare in that other place? You and I more or less experience this, more or less, in the sense that after the Holocaust came over this country, Beyond Cutler and Salman Rebbe, this one, now, you know, all those types. In other words, they were European Gedola, but all of a sudden Europe became untenable. And so they came as refugees to America, and each one became something to influence the Americans to one degree or another, even though they weren't American. So it's very interesting to me. If you look at the 15th century and the 16th century, at least in my reckoning, there were like three Mekomos HaTorah that I know of. One was France, one was Germany, and one Spain. I'm not talking, when I say Germany, those are the heirs of the old Balitosis and that sort of thing, but they were kicked out of northern Spain, and they ended up in various parts of Germany. Ashkenaz. Then there were others, French Jews from southern France, who had a somewhat different Torah tradition. It's not exactly the Provence, but it's similar. And they were eventually kicked out of France. I mentioned this the other day by Louis XII. And they go to Italy. That's like the Maharik and those type of people. So they brought their Mesoras. I've had to do Yiddishkeit and how to learn Gemara from France. And the third one is Spain, which in 1492, they get kicked out of Spain. And they bring their Torah traditions and learning style, Gemara stuff, almost primarily, I think, to the Middle East, to the Eastern Mediterranean. Ottoman Empire, Arab world, not to other places, which is just interesting. So our hero is part of that, except that he goes to Italy. Now, I probably confused you, so let me take the story from the beginning. Our hero is named Yosef Yabetz. He's Sephardi. Spain in the 1400s was a heck of a place. In the late 1300s, these gigantic pogroms and stuff broke out, and 50% of the population converted to Christianity because it was a knife at their throat. We spoke about that a lot in the past. The survivors somehow hung on. Were very niedergeschlagen, you know, really in bad shape. But after 1421, things sort of revived to some degree. And that's the era of Compton and I forget who else I spoke about in connection with that. Benvenisti. And they sponsored what you and I today would call a Torah Renaissance. Because they took their money and put into yeshivas, to put in simple terms. And the old yeshivas were busted from the pogroms. So if you're looking at Spain in the 1400s or the 15th century, as we call it, you see an interesting situation where there's a whole yeshiva world of new yeshivas, just like in America, popped up new yeshivas after the Holocaust. And there's this great article online. I'm so dumb, I can't get it straight. I can see it only on the side, from Professor Gross, called Hayeshiva Becastilia. And he's talking about the 15th century. And you can see it. There's in Leon and in Zamora. That's where the Katie Sitzik was. That's where Compton was, by the way. It's in Salamanca, which was the famous university there. That's already interesting. It's like Padua, you know. Next door to university was a big yeshiva. And, you know, Guadalajara. Places that hadn't, Segovia, places that hadn't been Mekom Sator in a famous way, all of a sudden became. And our hero grows up in that milieu. Because he's born in 1440. I told you the Jews started to revive the yeshivas in the 1421 and after. Yitzhak Kompantan had a lot of Talmidim and a lot of Mobin yeshivas in different places. Or became Rabbanim in different places. One of them, Yosef Chayun, ended up in Lisbon in Portugal, which is not that far away. And our hero was either born in Portugal or he came there as a young child. You know, none of this stuff is 100% clear. The records in these things are not great. All we know is that he grew up a frum kid in Lisbon in the 15th century. He was close with Yosef Chayun, who was the Rav there. He talks about him all the time. It's clear that he did a lot of learning under him. It's also clear, by the way, in terms of what we're selling in Gnosim, that, and he says it, a lot of his stuff in Pirkei Avos he picked up from his Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Chayun. You know, forts, interpretations of different passages in the Pirkei Avos. He also, by the way, oh, hold on for a second. Yeah, here it is. I pulled the book out that I was looking for. Our hero, Yosef Yabetz, so he learns intimate with the Rav, but he also is friends, or got into the circle of the Barbanel. This past summer, I did the Barbanel in detail in terms of being a court Jew, and our hero is born in 1440, so he's growing up in the 40s and the 50s of the 15th century, and the Barbanel was in Lisbon for a lot of that time, and at that time he was loaded to the gills. I won't go into the details. You can listen to the lecture if you want. But he was a loaded baby. Now, being the Barbanel, he not only lived in a palace, all the rest of it, but he had intellectual interests as well. He's not one of these rich people, rich Jews, who are intellectually vapid, but the opposite. And the Barbanel, Yitzhak Barbanel, that is, once in a while had shiurim in his house. In different things. He talks about it in his writings. So you have to understand, if I went to his shir, it's like going into, Rothschild's palace for to hear the guy give it, you know, surrounded by servants and luxury, to hear a shir in Tanakh or in something else. So our hero, Yosef Yabetz, attended the Abarbanel's chug in Mor Nebuchim, of all things, which testifies to the fact that he had not only an intellectual interest, but also a spiritual interest, because at the end of the day, the Mor Nebuchim is one way, I said one way, of trying to understand spiritual matters. There's a great book called Nevuchim Haim, Masab Bebi Rosh Al Bitzuk Abarbanel Mor Nebuchim. There's a guy in Israel, Ben Zazum. I think Bernie, God bless him, got me this from Israel. And it goes into great detail on the Barbanel and his Shir, the student, you know, the guy, his chug, you might say, and his different opinions, which are many, in the Mor Nebuchim. As you know, the Barbanel is one of the four classic commentaries of Mor Nebuchim, and he's always a critic of the Rambam from the right. In other words, he's always, if you're interested, I mean, it's what you're interested in. If you're interested in a frumy critique of the murder of the Shitas of Rambam and the murder of Nevuchim, one place you can go is in the Bar Mil's commentary in the murder of Nevuchim. So imagine a guy growing up and going as a teenager to a chug like this and hawking and debating murder of Nevuchim stuff with the Brahman and the other people at the shir. You see already his intellectual profile. He's not just another yeshiva student, although he is that. It's not just Gemar, although he is that, definitely. But he's also interested in what you and I would call hashkafa matters, you know, ideological matters, philosophical matters, and so forth. Now, he ends up living in Spain. I think he met the Barbara there also. So, I don't remember the years. I think it's the 1460s to 1492, I think. And that means he's in Spain as slowly but surely the king and the queen, Ferdinand and Isabella, slowly but surely squeeze the Jews till they crush them. Because there are already Xeris coming out in the 1470s and the 1480s. And you and I know it culminates in 1492. But I think I've said this in other times. If you know your history well, just get Lindo, Ilias Chaim Lindo. He wrote this in the 1800s. It's got all the details of the different Xeris, I mean, in detail, against the Jews in the time of Ferdinand and Isabella. First, they said Jews can't live in this part of Spain. Then they said they can't live in that part of Spain. So in other words, the final expulsion decree of 1492 was just the Makkah B'Potash. That's all it was. It was progressing in that direction anyway. Moreover, they were already making rules like, if you're a from Jew and you're allowed to be a Jew, if you don't tell on others who are secret Jews, you'll get burned. You know what I'm saying? So you have to be a Malshin. It was just terrible. So that's the world in which our hero grows up. Now, that means he's a product of the yeshiva system of the 15th century in Spain, which is a time of Iyun, which is this very specifically late Sephardic form of Pilpul, or classic Pilpul. In order to understand that, you read the book of Darkei HaGemara. He is a Kampantan with a certain way of reading and asking questions. I did this already in the past. Remember, first you read the Gemara without Rashi Tosis. Then once you figure it out, then read Rashi. If Rashi said what you felt, you do not pat yourself on the back, you have Akasha. If you could figure out whether Rashi, why did Rashi bother to say it? You know, it's a certain approach, right? It's got its own form of dialectics. And as far as I know, our hero does not publish anything in Gemara and Poskim. He'll be famous for other things. Now, a lot of his stuff is still in manuscript, so I can't generalize, and I might be wrong. But in terms of historical impact, he's dead 500 years now. It's not been here with Gemara and Poskim. It's in other, it's Ashkofa type stuff. So that's just very interesting. Now, so he's a rabbi somewhere, you know. He gave his classes, he did whatever he did. Then, of course, comes the great crisis of 1492. Jews have to stay or leave. Most Jews rove Castilia Bark la Portugal, as the Shevet Yehuda puts it. Right? Those Jews in Spain, and remember, Spain was two kingdoms, Castile and Aragon, joined together. Those who converted to Christian. Those who didn't had to leave the country. So many of them, probably most, moved next door to Portugal. So if you don't know what I'm talking about, shame on you for your lack of knowledge of basic geography. But Portugal is in the same peninsula as Spain, it's to the left of it. And that's because the king of Portugal had promised them that they could stay Jewish over there. They would just have to pay him taxes. In other words, he did it for commercial reasons. Okay, the Jews were happy with that, they thought. But within a couple of years, I think 1496, because of a certain marriage and this and that and the other, the king of Portugal turned on a dime and said, I changed my mind, and all of you Jews now have to convert. And he did force them to convert. I mean, physically forced them to convert. Physically forced them to convert. So that was a bummer and a half. And then started all the terrible sufferings. And obviously, Jews wanted to get the heck out of there. But he closed the ports. He locked them in the country. So some got out and some didn't get out. And now you start with the Anusim and the Muranos and all that business. Our hero did go to Portugal, but clearly he wasn't planning to stay there because within a short time, in that window of opportunity, before the king changed his mind, knows shortly after 1492, he left Portugal and he went to Italy. So this is interesting. Maybe he smelled that something was going to happen. Or else, as I would say, the ultimate plan is to move towards Eretz Yisrael because, like many in his generation, Mazozo Sol Himlonu, they couldn't understand and they wanted to understand what is this catastrophe that hit the Spanish Jewry? Now, again, sitting here in America on a pot belly and, you know, full of food, and everything's okay. So we say, didn't you see the handwriting on the wall? First they said you couldn't do this, and then they made this gzera and that gzera. And the final expulsion decree in 1492 was only the Makkabei Potash. But they didn't experience it the way I'm saying. They kept hoping against hope that this will be the next, this gzera is the last one. Or when the next one popped up, the next one will be the last one. One second. Sorry about that. The next one will be, you know, the last gzera. Then the king and queen will change their mind. Those they hoped against hope. And, of course, they were wrong. So this was experienced in such a terrible way. And remember, the Jews who left Spain suffered a lot. They weren't tortured by the Spanish exactly, but they were open, fresh game. If you took them to ship, you could throw them overboard if you want to steal their money, or starve them to death, or sell them to slavery, or rape them. All these things happen a lot. Missing the Shevet Yehuda in such places. And so the Jews who left Spain, the Sephardim Torim, they suffered a lot. Our hero did a little bit differently. So, you know, like I say, he went to Portugal, and then from Portugal he took a ship. But I don't know if he suffered or didn't suffer. He finally made it to Naples in Italy in 1493. Like the Abarbanel. Naples, of course, as I've said 1,000 times, was a kingdom within Italy. There was no country called Italy, a single country. Italy was divided into a whole bunch of different states. And I'll say what I always say. Go Google a map of Renaissance Italy and you'll see the different states. The Jews landed in Naples. The king at that time, Ferrante, Ferdinand, said they could stay. Even though he's a terrible tyrant, somehow or other, the Jews he didn't hurt. But he died within a short while. And the French invaded the famous Zach. This is why the Barbanel had to flee. In other words, let's put it this way. You figure you landed on safe ground, and then the safe ground turns into fire. And so he couldn't stay in Naples. And within a relatively short time, I won't go through all the Renaissance politics, the Spanish conquered the Kingdom of Naples and remained part of the Kingdom of Spain for the next 200 years. Right? In other words, Spain had an empire, and the empire included Kingdom of Naples and Sicily. So, obviously, just like Spain said in Spain, no Jews are allowed to live here, and we're going to introduce the Inquisition. They did in Naples also, so forget that. So our hero, this around 1495, I don't know, 6, 7, 8, doesn't matter to you. He flees to another country in Italy, because that's always what you had to do. If they kick you out of one place, you go to another. And he went north to Ferrara, which was famous as a place where the Duke, for his own reasons, during Hercules, the Duke d'Este. These are all, I mean, they don't mean anything to you, but if you know a little bit of Italian history, these are the famous ruling families of yesteryear. Gonzaga, Medici, d'Este, and so forth. So, the Duke allowed Muranos, or I said it wrong, the Duke allowed fleeing Jews from Spain to come and settle in his duchy, Duke of Ferrara. And most of the time, the Dukes of Ferrara were okay. The only and that's why Ferrara became an important Jewish center, and probably the number one, I'll call them Muranos, you know, the Spanish Jewish center. Remember, the Sephardim were not native to Italy. They're from Spain. But now they come in some numbers to Spain. I mean, to Italy, including our hero, Yosef Yabetz. And Ferrara did become a Mokum Torah. I was there. I told you before. I spoke Lampronti. It's beautiful. See, all these Spanish, Italian cities are very pretty, at least to me. I don't say the people are, but the pretty cities are. And he was there for a while. But for whatever reason, let's put it this way. He's now a refugee among other refugees. Right after 1492, 1493. And he's got another 10, 15 years to live. What's the metzias he finds himself in? He got Italy. And little by little, every month or so, some Jews are running away from Spain and Portugal to Italy, to different places. But when you finally land in Italy, it wasn't always so pushy. He had to start life all over again. It's like the Holocaust victims who came to America, they had to start a business all over again. Some were successful, some not. And you've been traumatized by what happened in Spain and Portugal. And you see that the Jews who left behind in Spain and Portugal, who converted to Christian, kept their property. And little by little, you start feeling like a dummy, you know. And in general, Mazosa Solahim Lanu. It sounds like a terrible catastrophe. And the Mashiach has not come. Bishlamov, it was World War III. And you see the culmination in Shevli Mashiach. So that's one thing. But you don't see it. And you and I, sitting here in the year 2024, know there was nothing like that. So everybody was bewildered, hashkafically. Okay? What did we do? Spain was so great. I think it's very famous that our hero undertakes to go around speaking as a public speaker, a darshan, in the different little communities where the Spanish Jews have settled. All through, I say, northern and central Italy, because he's their flesh and blood. I'm sure he spoke to them in Spanish, Castilian, or probably the Spanish Yiddish, you know, whatever that was. He's not Italian, he doesn't speak Italian. So he goes to this kehilla and this kehilla, and he gives speeches. And it becomes a drushes, a chassid yairitz. You understand? And what's interesting is, he's a super frummy. So therefore, he applies the clap. I'll use this term. He's like the Victor Miller of the 16th century, 15th century. In other words, Rabbi Victor Miller will say, like, it's why the Holocaust happened, because of the avarice of the Jews in Europe. I don't like to hear it myself, but I'm speaking now from a scholarly perspective. Right? The Jews did this wrong, different than the Nazis did that. Well, basically, he's inspired by Chassid Yossi Yavitz. Because he says, very famously, that the Jews in Spain were kicked out and suffered so much because of Limudi Chol, right? You know, he won't criticize the Rambam directly, but he sure criticized him indirectly, and especially the Talmidei Rambam, who were the people involved in the Maimonidean controversies and afterwards. And basically, we do know that the Sephardim in second half of the Middle Ages, which would be your 1200s, 1300s, 1400s, your Sephardim, who lived in Christian Spain by this time, because the Christians had already conquered 95% of Spain. There was the elites constituted several groups. One of the elites would be the Rishi Rishis. One of the elites would be your philosophical intellectuals, people into science and philosophy, who are usually pretty dismissive of and critical of religion. Like, they use stupid frummies, that kind of thing. And a lot of them were Michal Shabbos and things like this, because after all, what really counts is the intellectual apprehension of God, the understanding of an invisible, unknowable sort of thing. It doesn't matter that much whether or not you light a candle on Saturday. You understand? And Drabonans, give me a break. This was the problem with the antinomian Averroists, as they said. And I've spoken about this before. Now, this is an old theme. Shemtov and Shemtov said this already 100 years before in the Sefer Emunis, as I mentioned a couple months ago. It's a very Haredi way of blaming others for what happened to you. And excuse me. Our hero, a bit cold. Our hero writes whole books based on his speeches, in which he analyzes the sins of the Sephardim and how they cause the expulsion, the catastrophe. And it's a very right-wing kind of critique. And like I said before, got too much involved in Geisha stuff and too much involved in skeptical philosophical speculation. From philosophical speculation is one thing. Skeptical is another. Although, to tell you the truth, there weren't too many from philosophical speculators in 15th century in Spain. Instead, the real from were going into Kabbalah. Our hero is therefore considered a very good, he must have been a very good speaker, because he was in demand. After a while, he's not getting enough money in Ferrara, so he has to look elsewhere, because he's in his 50s and he has a family. And so he moves, guess where? To Mantua. That's why this podcast is connected with what I've been doing lately about famous people from the community of Mantua. It's not surprising he would move to Mantua. Had big yeshivas there. The main influence are the French Jews, like I say, the Maharik types, who ran away from southern France, or their parents or grandparents did. But they brought that kind of Mesorah with them. So you have in Italy something what I consider very interesting, and that is you have really four groups, A, B, C, and D. You have the, so I'm not talking about the local Italians, the natives, because they didn't really produce too many great Torah scholars. But you got the Ashkenazim, you got the Sephardim, and the French. The French came in the 15th century. The Sephardim came in the 16th century. The Ashkenaz came all through the 14th, 15th, 16th century. The Ashkenaz brought their way of learning, their yeshiva style, to northern Italy. And that's the yeshiva in Padua, and also later in Mantua. Right? It's like a German Yiddish-speaking Ashkenazic yeshiva transplanted to Italy. The Sephardim bring their style of yeshiva, which grew up on its own, in Spain in 15th century, after the debacle of 1421 is over. And that's the Iyun and all that other stuff. And they bring theirs, and they have a yeshiva among others in Mantua as well. Their own. That's who our hero is part of. And the French Jews come, mainly in 15th century, and they bring their stuff, that's the Maharik, Messer Leon, and all those others. So Italy was just as hot as gekocht, you know what I mean? Italy in the 1400s, 1500s was very interesting in being a cross section of different styles of Jewish ethnicities as well as Jewish styles of learning. Our hero is located in the Spanish part of that. Okay? He becomes a big darshan. And he has a famous charge there, which may be true or not. And that is that the catastrophe happened because of Limud Chol, Kalus B'mitzvahs, what I'll call in general, an extreme modern orthodoxy. And maybe that's not the right word. Because, in other words, he's talking about Kalus B'mitzvahs, whatever. Now, he says very famously, I don't have it in front of me, but it's always quoted in his name, because he wrote a book, he wrote several books, and one of them was Or HaChaim. This is not the same thing as Or HaChaim HaKadosh Yom Nechomish. And he says, I was there when the Gezeres hit Spain, and all the so-called dumb Jews that the intellectuals, I mean, the Amoratzim and Shul. But he meant like this, the simple, pious, regular Yid who comes for Shachris and Mincha and has no big pretensions and, you know, will sit and someone else says the Shir or something like that and they don't understand all the fancy Gemara stuff. And they certainly are too uneducated to understand the Mor Nevuchim and Kabbalah and all the other business. So they just had simple Emunah Pshuta. They are the ones, he says, who showed the intestinal fortitude to turn down all the pressures and offerings of the Catholics in 1492 to stay. And they dropped everything and gave everything up and left Spain to retain their Yiddishkeit, even at the cost of a lot of suffering on the way. But the people who had been rabbis, who had been big in Limud Chol, especially in philosophy and metaphysics, which always made them skeptical about the mitzvahs ma'asius and things like that, even though they're very learned in Talmid Chacham and all the rest of it, they folded like a house of cards. So when the Spanish said, either you leave, either you stay and keep your property, but then you have to convert, or you give up all your property and get out of here, they couldn't bring themselves to give up all their property, so they stayed and converted and became Catholics. And they meant it. So what's the point of philosophy if it simply weakens your resolve? If the purpose of a philosophical religious education is to say, listen, I don't really know if God exists. I just take it as a matter of faith. Well, I mean, I get it, but your faith is not very strong. And if a wind comes, the house will fall down. You see? As opposed to a regular Jew who says, I believe it. My father believed it. My mother believed it. My grandparents believed it. Now I'm part of the Shalshalas HaKabbalah. That's who I am. So then you don't debate with, you don't argue with, you don't pressure. They take it on the chin, and they say, we're willing to drop all of our gashmias and leave the country and start all over again, which is very hard in life when you're middle-aged or older, even when you're young. There's a famous critique of what they call the Chassid Yavetz against the Limud Chol. He says, in other words, if you follow this interpretation, the whole suffering of the Jews in Spain was a function of this skeptical attitude, of this arrogance that came from the study of philosophy, arrogance, I say, which made them think they're better than the other. Therefore, they're able to do things than the other. And really, it was all Yetzer Hara. And the proof that it was Yetzer Hara is when the time came for the Nisayim of 1492, they folded like a house of cards and they converted. This became part of Jewish history, this attitude. And down till today, and elsewhere, in the Haredi world, especially in the Hasidic world, they love the Chassid Yavetz. Because he is articulating a position of fideism, which means the middle of Shuta. That's why the Hasidim are the ones who republished his books, and they expanded them, including the book that we're selling today, that Gnosim is selling today, which is pre-Hasidic, but the Hasidim are the ones who republished it later on with all kinds of implications, because they love the Chassid Yavetz because of his attack on sichlasanus, on intellectuality, and his primacy, valoration of the emunah pshuta. Okay? Now, this is not entirely correct from a historical perspective. There's a wonderful rejoinder to all this, so years ago, in an article by Professor Toshma, Yisrael Toshma, who died already. He was a big brain in Israel, from Guy, and he knew all the Ksav Yads. He was in charge of the Machon L'Tatzlumi Kitva Yad, among other things, right? And anyhow, you see, if you know all the stuff that was written that he hasn't even been published, he argues, that the Jews were firmer than you said, and it's not true that all the people with philosophy fold like a house of cards, and it's a canard, it's a lie. And you find from both parties, both gave in. Meaning, it's a matter of human being, you know, personality, who you are. Are you able to resist the pressure, or you're not able to resist the pressure? It's not necessarily a function of how member of the elites or member of a common man. But I can guarantee you something. I saw this article, because I'm that type of person. I have the collection of Toshma's articles, which I think are great, in four or five volumes. I think it's called Knesset Mivch. Knesset, I have it. Here, let me pull it out. Knesset Mechkarim, Iyunim B'Sifrut HaRabbanit B'Mei HaBinayim, Studies in Rabbinic Culture in Malaysia. He's got all these different articles. He's great. I mean, he knows his stuff. But I can tell you right now, nobody's read the Toshman articles. You know what I mean? Everybody for the last 500 years has read the Chassid Yavetz. That became the mantra. That became the well-known sort of thing. And I'm not denying that the Spanish were a bunch of mamzerim. No question about it. Question is it true that, you know, only those with emunah of Shuta were able to withstand the Inquisition or the threats of the Inquisition? That is not really true. But it became true because he wrote it and the book was published and it spread everywhere. And the Chassidim Yonah Bnei Yisoscha wrote a parish on it. It's called Or HaChaim, the book from Chassid Yavetz. Again, it's not the Or HaChaim HaKadosh from Chaim Ben Attar from Morocco, you know, they have in the Mikras Gedolos. It's a different one, but it's very famous. Now, he therefore made a living as being a, you know, an itinerant preacher, as they call it. He used to go from place to place and give speeches. Shiurim. And that's how he supported his family. And in Mantua, he obviously had a community with a lot of learners and yeshiva bachurim and things like that. And he could devote himself to it. They call him Chassid Yavetz because he lived a very pious lifestyle. They always have these quotes that contemporaries say, oh, Yosef Yavetz, I've seen him in Mantua, he's no adorish nor mekayim. Meaning, he not only talks the talk, he also walks the walk. You know, get up for taking chatzos, the whole 9 yards. And I'll say it again, as far as we can tell, because I haven't seen the unpublished stuff, his forte was not the Gemar stuff, but the others. See, he would be perfect, I think, today for a role of a mashgiach in a modern yeshiva or manal ruchni or something like that. I mean, because he's very thoughtful. And in general, these are the years of the 1490s, early 1500s. So people are getting out of Spain and Portugal. The Inquisition sufferings are raw. Everybody knows people who've been tortured to death and things like that. Everybody knows relatives and whatever that someone got caught and burned alive. You're living in Italy, northern Italy. In Mantua and in Ferrara at that time, it was okay. The dukes, for their own reasons, protected the Jews. But it's not a Dover Pashit. And all of them, I think, had the idea, this is a Mashiach site. And some of us, Sephardim, have already moved to Eretz Yisrael to greet the Mashiach, and we'll have a new state of Israel, from state of Israel. He certainly felt that way. It didn't happen. But that's the, what's the right word? The tension in the air. If you're in Italy, in a Sephardic synagogue or community, that means you're one of the frumis, because you didn't, you know, fold and become a Christian in order to stay behind in Spain. And so you're listening to the wars and the international politics. You're reading the Parsha Shavua, other parts of Tanakh, Gemara, and you're trying to collate them and figure out how far away is Mashiach time. Another year, another 10 years, 20 years, who knows? You know, who knows? So it was a heck of time to live. Now, in the middle of all this, he had a lot of different writings. And he was a charismatic person, you know, from others, based on what others say. And like I say, from his writings eventually get published, it's Or HaChaim, which is the attack on rationalism, on Maimonideanism. It's like, it's somewhat like the Sefer Emunis from Shem Tov. You know, that sort of Mahalach. And he also has stuff on Maimonidean philosophical issues, which I don't think are so interesting to people today. Like, you know, what are the Ikrim in Judaism? Like the Sefer Ikrim, what are the fundamentals? And how would you define a fundamental? You know, like the Sefer Ikrim, like the Rambam, are there 13 principles? Are there two? Are there one? I don't think, it doesn't speak to the 21st century, in my opinion. It obviously, to him, it did. You know what I mean? And aside from all these theological type of works, he has his commentary on Pirkei Avos, which was published after his death. And herein lies the tale because, as I said before, as best as I can tell, I don't think much was at all published on Pirkei Avos as a genre in the 1400s. After all, Pirkei Avos is simply a Masechta in the Mishnayos, in the Shas. It's one of 60. It's a little different than the others, possibly. I get that. But it's one of the set. For some reason, in the 16th century and afterwards, Pirkei Avos really took off. As you know, Rabbi Yosef Karo and others were misaking that they should learn on Shabbos afternoon. It became a favor on Shabbos afternoon. I imagine the reason is because a lot of the Jews ran away from Spain. They were not learned necessarily. You can't do a shiur with them in Baba Kama, you know? I mean, in other words, their eyes will close. Pirkei Avos, you can spin any way you want. And material is always interesting, unless you're a dummy. Unless the speaker's a dummy. And so, clearly, he had heard this from Yosef Chayun, like I said before. He says, I heard this from my Rebbe here, Rebbe there. And you end up with what is called his commentary on Pirkei Avos. Now, he died in 1508. It wasn't published for 50 years. But nevertheless, it was out there and circulating manuscript. And when it was published, there were problems with it, but you don't need to know the nitty-gritty. It's always the Defus Rishon and the others. The Hasidim are the ones who published it second time, like in the 1800s. See what I'm saying? Because he was a hero by the Hasidim, because he's always dissing the rationalism and intellectuality and praising Emunah Pshuta. And Hasidus, certainly the early Hasidus, was founded on a primacy of Emunah Pshuta. What's the classic Hasidic tale? The guy's in trouble. The Rebbe says, you know, jump off the bridge, the Bay Bridge. And the guy don't ask no question. He does it. At the last minute, something great happens to him as a result of that. You know, when that's, you know, the classic Hasidic tale. So the valorization, we call this fideism. The belief that, the idea that belief is a better road to reality than reason. Think about that. And he's a champion of that. He wasn't a dummy. He didn't say go blind. He didn't say close your eyes and walk off the cliff. But notice he believed in rationality, but not in rationalism. Rationality means basic ways of conducting yourself. You don't do crazy things. Rationalism means that reason is the sovereign principle in the universe, and religion has to bend to that reason. And that the Bible and all the other works have to reinterpret in light of that reason. He doesn't like that. And so when you read the Perush Chassid Yavetz, especially now, I think the second edition added things in the first one. But now I'm looking at this new guy that I picked up the book today, and he says the Defus Rishon, which is what they're publishing, is in some cases more accurate than the stuff that they tried to introduce and fix it. Like I said before, I have a whole, this is like a deluxe edition, but it's only the first part. Okay, it's only the first part, and it's one of these mafarshim on Pirkei Avos. So I guess coming to Italy, he needed something to talk about on Shabbos afternoon. So I'm very serious. And back in Spain, they used to use the menorah hamor, but here in Italy, apparently they switched to Pirkei Avos. Maybe because that gave you more of a way to be mechadish yourself. I'm not sure 100% the reason. And as you know, over the course of the 16th century, Pirkei Avos became what it is today. Well, I shouldn't say that because I'm living in Baltimore, Maryland, and I'm sure in a lot of other yeshiva type places, one of the reforms of yeshiva reform Judaism is to cut out Pirkei Avos on Saturday afternoon. That's what it seems to me. When I grew up, that's what you did. You know, the part of davening, and now they don't. They go right from Sikos Hatzedek to Olenu. Okay, I mean, I understand that. But there was a while when it was really hot. And, you know, Pirkei Avos, a lot of people into it anyway. And that's what the Chavis, so when we see the Pirush of the Yavetz, he clearly was a talented speaker. That's what the old contemporaries say. And these are speeches he must have given in different times on Pirkei Avos. Now think about this. If you give a summer's worth of shiurim on Pirkei Avos, and then you do it a year later, and then a year later, and then a year later, after a while you figure out what you want to say. You know what I mean? And that seems to be what happened over there. In the world of the scholarship, if you get this new edition, which is called Pirush Chassid Yavetz HaSholin, Amasech Dezavos in Biur Minchas Chayim. I don't know who that is. But somebody's obviously super into fan into this. So you see, we're talking about a book which has a very distinct kind of photographic moment in time. It's right after the expulsion of the Jews in Spain. It's the Jews in Spain who made it to Italy and are now breathing. They're in a certain shock over what just happened to them. You have this guy, Yosef Yabetz, doing his best in his way, Lefi Hashkafaso, to try to explain the logic and the sense of what happened to them, and to give the suffering a reason, you see? And he's using the vehicle of Pirkei Avos, which is full of dramatic and non-dramatic things, as his method, as his vehicle. And it's actually quite fascinating. So, I don't think the art school did Chassi Yavetz, but they will. And as I said before, I never went into Chassi Yavetz, you know, consistently, but I always see it from time to time in the Medrash Shmuel, which is a classic compendium from the 16th century also. But there are many others, Yosef Ben Nechamia, I mean, it's all kind of people got into the idea, especially Sfardim, of writing commentaries and explanations over here. Now, sometimes one borrows from the other. I just glanced inside, and he quotes the Haggadah Shel Pesach, where it says, you know, Halach Manya, all the rest of it. And what you're really saying is, you know, Hashat Tahoch Hashanah Bnei Chorin, all the rest of that. Don't feel, talking to a guest coming to eat by you by the Seder, don't have anywhere else to go, don't feel like a stranger. All of us were once upon a time guests at someone else's table. I saw that interpretation long ago in Azariah Figo, but now I see Azariah Figo got it from, you know, from the Chassid Yavetz. Okay, big deal. Big deal. It's an interesting word anyway. And so we have here somebody who's a survivor from the Spanish milieu. He had seen Spain, if I can use this word, even though it sounds ironic, in its glory, in terms of the yeshivas that it had. And then it all came crashing down. And he spends the rest of his life trying to make sense out of it, because what Holocaust survivors need more than anything else is some kind of understanding of the sense of it. Why did this happen? You see? Can't be just happened randomly. Then that's what a non-believer says. It's all contingent, and it had to happen. And you were just screwed because you were in the wrong place at the wrong time. The utter lack of meaning in that can kill somebody more than the suffering itself. And the Yavetz is one of the champions of the other way around. That's why his books became big favorites. The Hasidim, the non-Hasidim, the Haredim, because he articulates his point of view 500 years ago. And that's what they're offering. Like I say, if you're a player, that's one thing you want to say. I think it was lot number 106, if I'm not mistaken. And, you know, this is the Tekufa, the Arizal, and all these other things. If the Medrash Shmuel is quoting from it, it means that the Talmidei Arizal were Machshav, the Chassid Yavetz's Pirush and Pirkei Avos, and they were. And so it became, I would say, a golden oldie and a classic. If you're interested, and this is really a slice of history, from the middle of 16th century, then it's yours plus $30,000 or something like that. Anyway, I'm doing this once again. I want to thank Gnazim for sponsoring this. And again, their auction is this week on the Sunday and Tuesday, I think, March 3 and March 5. And we'll see who is it. But if any of you who are listening to this end up purchasing this, send me an email or something, or a WhatsApp or whatever, so I'll know, because that could be interesting to me. And with that, I wish you all a good day.
For sponsorship opportunities or to support this podcast, please visit our donate page at www.support.rabbidovidkatz.com.